It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Generations of people have made a life on the south shore of Lake Superior and established strong bonds with the Big Lake and bear witness to its shifting landscape. Author Sue Leaf presents her appreciation for this natural wonder and its vulnerabilities from her cabin near Port Wing, where her family has watched the seasons change for over three decades now. The number to be part of this book conversation, it's 800-642-1234. Ask a question, share your thoughts at any point. Email is ideas@wpr.org. Sue Leaf's new memoir is called Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior's South Shore. Sue, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be here.
So as a Minnesota native, your relationship with Lake Superior begins as a child, as does mine in Two Harbors. How would you compare the north and south shores of the lake?
Well, I knew only the north shore until I took this bike trip with my boyfriend, who would eventually become my husband. The north shore for me, I remember wanting to swim in it. In the water when I was a child, and my mother, whose parents both grew up in Duluth, said, "No one swims in Lake Superior." And it was beautiful. I loved climbing on the rocks, and I still look forward to any trip we're going to take up there.
I feel that same way. You know, my family would go to this very rustic cabin outside of Two Harbors, and on the way up, I would always like send up this little prayer, like miraculously the lake would warm up so I could go into it. And it was never answered.
No, not on the North Shore. So on the South Shore, Tom suggested that we take this bike trip. He had in mind, we would go from Ontonagon to Duluth along the South Shore all the way. And we ended up in Ontonagon close to midnight. Tom put our bikes together right downtown, and then we bicycled out to the campgrounds in the dark and put up the tent. And the next morning, I looked out over the campgrounds to the lake beyond them, and I thought, my goodness, look at all that water. And there's no rocks. It's all a sand beach. It looks like Cape Cod. And that whole day, I was just almost mesmerized by it. And that night when we got into our campsite, we changed into swimsuits and we went down into that water and we went swimming. And it was marvelous.
It's like a totally different body of water.
Except that it was cold. It was quite cold in August in 1970. What was that? 77? Yeah.
You found a community in Ashland in the 1980s, and you still regret not staying there longer. What did you come to miss about living in Ashland?
Well, we missed the people, first of all. What I missed, which propelled us forward to buy a cabin, was in Ashland, there was always a sense that the sky to the north was lighter than the rest of the sky, even if it was cloudy. And I think that was the sun reflecting off the water. And it just seemed like you were always oriented towards the lake being there. And I missed having that daily kind of a compass to orient by.
You called it Ashland top of the world. I love that. That's just so beautiful. We're talking about the new book, Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. Author Sue Leaf with us. You can join in with questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I wonder about how you talk about the Lake Superior. I mean, I think about all the different ways we say Lake Superior. You heard from how people called it a misunderstood beauty, and that the lake is boss, referring it to, you know, to this, the lake as she. Why do you think that is?
I think, well, the first comment was made by an artist who lives in Ashland, and the second one is a saying that gets passed around, especially among the fishing community in Bayfield. But I think it's more generalized than that. These are people that have a real intimate relationship with the lake. to the point where it's personal. And so I think that's how they can refer to the lake in human terms.
Let's examine vulnerabilities. In 1988, particularly hot summer then, prolonged drought was described by NASA likely due to global warming. What did you understand about global warming at that time?
Well, I actually was aware of global warming. My textbook in college, my ecology textbook, had a sentence or two about the possibility that the atmosphere could warm up and act like a greenhouse. They were calling it the greenhouse effect at that time. And throughout my grad school years, people would talk about it, but we didn't feel any of its effects at that point. But it was always in the back of my mind that something like that could happen. I remember the first time I thought maybe we were witnessing that was due to global warming, and a tornado, a very freak tornado in March, came through and wiped out my college campus. And I thought, gosh, I'll bet this has the possibility to take down every single place that I love.
How do you find climate change affecting Lake Superior now and that urgency?
Well, the lake is warming. I just watched a special documentary it's called A Sea Change for Lake Superior. It has algal blooms on occasion now, which it never did, which we have seen on our beaches. The lake is more cloudy. The high sea levels of Lake Superior, high lake levels, it's hard to pinpoint them all precisely to climate change, but climate change is definitely a factor in why the lake levels are at record highs. And that is affecting our cliffs, our red clay cliffs, and they are eroding at a rapid pace.
You toured Kokagon Sloughs with Bad River Tribal Chairman Mike Wiggins Jr. Wiggins was on our program in 2022 reflecting on climate change in the Great Lakes.
When you think about climate change, you know, Lake Superior is the fastest warming of all the Great Lakes. There's studies that show by 2060, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan won't even be receiving ice cover, full ice cover, and or ice cover in general. Those are alarming scenarios. And so, you know, we're trying to do our best in real time to put a little bundle of preservation together to send into the future with this place.
What did you learn from tribal leaders about how they treat this watershed and efforts to preserve Lake Superior?
Well, it should be an existential problem for all of us, but for the Ojibwe, they really feel it because their whole identity, their call, if you will, to be in this area is based on the lake and the health of the lake. So, yes, Wiggins is right, of course. And he's got it. He's nailed it. And he knows what the stakes are.
You mentioned the eroding cliff, your cabin near Port Wing. You know, over the more than 30 years, how quickly has erosion, you know, closed the gap between the cabin and the edge of the cliff?
Well, here's what we were told. When we bought the place, the former owners told us that the cliff was eroding at a rate of about a foot per year. And we thought, a foot per year, okay, we can live with that. And over the 30 years or so, the first 30 years, it was about a foot and a half per year, which is still, you know, within the range of acceptability. But then recently we lost 28 feet in 3 years. We began to see how close the cliff was coming to, for example, our well that's on the lake side of the cabin and then the cabin itself. And we thought, my gosh, this cabin could go into the drink in our lifetime. What are we going to do about that? We also have a marker called, which we call the Red Rock. It's a hunk of sandstone that was out in the water in front of our cabin. When we bought the cabin, we actually stood at the edge of the cliff and looked down on top of the red rock. And now the red rock is maybe 60 feet out from the cliff. And that's kind of is an attention gripper. Whenever we have friends come up to the cabin, we take them out to the cliff to show them the red rock.
We're talking with Sue Leaf, our guide. New book is called Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Sue Leaf gives us a glimpse of her relationship with Lake Superior and what binds her to the region. Her new memoir is called Impermanence, and it presents the ongoing complexities of climate change and the environmental threats to the South Shore's watershed. Join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share your views at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Turning to copper mining now, 6,000 years ago, indigenous people found copper on Isle Royale. They made fish hooks, spear tips from the metal. How quickly did Europeans arrive to mine the copper deposits throughout the region?
Well, they came in the 1840s. And I'm sorry, I don't know when Michigan became a state, but it must have been shortly before that. They came in the 1840s. Douglas Houghton came to check out the deposits, and they hadn't been exploited yet. And he literally found chunks of pure copper on the forest floor. And he came back, and I think within a year or two after Houghton was there, the first prospectors, the first Yankee prospectors were in the area and setting up mines, looking for mines.
So the copper mining boom, it continues for decades. How was the industry affected by the Civil War and changes in extraction methods?
Well, the Civil War actually provided a boon for the copper demand because of, for crazy as it is, brass buttons for the uniforms. And I think telegraph technology needs copper as well. The mines, that's when the Quincy mine and the Hancock mine really came into their own and hired a lot of people. They also lost copper miners to the war effort. Michigan would have had big drives to recruit soldiers for the war, and for like where the Cliff Mine was in Eagle River, they had marches with young men marching down and calling their fellow workers to come join the Union's effort in the Civil War. And you can imagine copper miners, young men in their 20s, would be perfect soldiers. And so they, for that reason, the mine operators, owners started looking to Europe and trying to attract Europeans into the area to run their mines.
And you draw our attention to the first casualty of copper mining being the woods, that the thick forest was no match, you write, for the axes and saws of the mining companies. How has the loss of old growth forests changed the landscape around Lake Superior?
Well, there's a species change, and it's hard for me to appreciate it on a personal level because I've never experienced a large stretch of old growth forest. There is an area on the tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula called the Estevan Pines. Really, really big old trees there, both pines and other species. And the first time I visited the Estevan Pines was in early August, many years ago now. And I remember seeing warblers in the pines that I had not seen in our cutover land at the cabin. And I thought, well, yeah, I suppose they attracted old growth warblers like we would not have. You know, there are other wildlife species that would have lived under the trees of the big expanse of forest that can't do so now in remnants.
And you even called the woods on your property damaged goods. The forest around your cabin, what has it endured through time?
Well, it was mostly clear cut around the turn of the last century in the 1900s. And the loggers left a handful of really big pines, mature white pines and mature red pines, a couple mature red pines. And then it was left by itself. It wasn't replanted or regenerated. And poplars came in, and they spread by root suckers. And so we have many stands of poplar trees, which may in fact be one individual because they share a common root structure. So they probably have the same genetic identity. And then we have balsam fir coming in underneath the poplars. And that will provide a good forest cover for us, probably not for me, but for my grandchildren.
For your generations.
Right, in the years to come.
So the forest has really had to kind of scramble for itself to do its own reforestation, at least in your area.
To bind up its wounds, right. Mm.
Sue Leaf, new book, Impermanence, as we talk about life and loss on Superior South Shore. Join in 800-642-1234 with your question, your comments. So how do mining tailings and threaten fish populations in Lake Superior today? What is the impact?
Well, you know, the tailings haven't been produced for many years now because the copper industry hasn't been active since World War II, and then it was only on a very limited basis. But the tailings from the stamp sands from the stamp equipment to purify the copper ore so it could be shipped, they were dumped in the lake. And for example, the one I'm thinking of right now is outside of, I think it's Gay, Michigan, that has it's right on Keweenaw Bay, and it's in a prime spawning area for fish, and the sands, when riled up, can get into the gills of the fish and clog them and literally suffocate small fish. But they also change the chemistry of the water, and it's caused pollution that's very hard for organisms to live in polluted waters.
I was struck by how you write how, as a society, we don't think about how mining stories end. What is that end that we prefer to not think about, that we tend to ignore?
Well, mining is an extractive activity. You have a quantity of resource that you want to use, and you use it up, and then you're left with a big hole in the ground. And hasn't happened everywhere there's been a mine. And nobody wants to talk about the afterwards, what happens after.
So what evidence of the heydays of copper mining is still evident in, like, the architecture of the towns that you visit along Lake Superior?
Well, of course, the best one is Calumet, Michigan. It's just a remarkable town. It has these gorgeous Richardsonian Romanesque sandstone buildings, many civic buildings, like their fire department. Well, what was the fire department back when it was a mining town? Big, gorgeous churches, an Elks Hall, I think. Downtown businesses are built from these sandstones that were a result of the money made from the mine.
So kind of the legacy of prosperous times in a mining place, but that too shall come to an end at some point.
Right, and you can see this, I mean, in other towns along the shore, like Marquette, Michigan, and Duluth, Minnesota, all have, in Superior, Wisconsin, have these nice red sandstone buildings dating from the time when copper, or in the case of Minnesota, iron ore, was king.
And you can see how they do stand the test of time, these buildings.
The buildings do, right. Mm-hmm.
From her cabin near Port Wing, Sue Leaf is taking us on this journey through Lake Superior's South Shore. Her new book is called Impermanence, And you can join the conversation at any point by calling in with a question. You can share your thoughts on the Great Lake, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with author Sue Leaf, whose new book expresses her respect and love for Lake Superior alongside the environmental challenges that take advantage of this natural treasure and its watershed. Her memoir is called Impermanence, and her family cabin is near Port Wing. Call in with the question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, we have a call here of appreciation. Linda Joy from Cribbets called in and says that they got a copy of your book yesterday and want to express that it is so beautifully written and it brings together ideas that people should seriously consider. And I have to say, I really want to elevate Linda Joy there. I agree. How has Lake Superior helped you like live in the moment and see life differently?
Well, I find that I am kind of taken by a horizon. Hmm. That horizons, I think, are soothing, and that they have a kind of a calming effect. And so it allows me to slow down and just think more carefully about what's happening to me and to others and how to live life more gracefully. I'm increasingly feeling hemmed in and crowded when I'm in the mountains now. And I think my mind and how it's working works now under the features of a flat net, like a prairie or a lake. And so that's what I really like about Lake Superior.
I picture you as a writer on Lake Superior, and I'm just wondering how it might affect your writing process or looking out over the lake.
Oh, I think it makes me a more expansive writer. Hmm. I'm more inclined to see what I'm writing about in big broad terms as being more universal and not just due to me, not just pertaining to me.
We heard from Frank, who has heard that the tectonic plate on the north side of the lake is rising because the ice sheet is leaving and it's tilting the lake. And because of that, yeah, Flooding will happen on the south side of the lake. And Frank is wondering, do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. Actually, it's called isotonic rebound. It's caused, when you think about it, the glacial ice sheets were a mile thick or more, and that's a lot of pressure to put on the surface of the earth. So if you think of pressing down on a marshmallow, how the marshmallow compresses, but if you raise your hand off the marshmallow rebounds back. Mm-hmm. That's in a very small way what's happening to our land now as the glacier is receding. And of course, it happened first on the south shore and now on the north shore. And so the north shore is actually rising with respect to the south shore. So if you think about it, it's like the whole basin of Lake Superior is tilting slightly to the south. And so the water tilts with it and flows into the creeks and into the along the cliff. And in fact, my son, who is a geologist, takes a look at the St. Louis Bay estuary by Duluth and Superior. and says, that looks like a flooded estuary to me, to my eye, because the water is tilting in towards the rivers and the inlets of that area.
What might that mean for the shoreline and what you see happening to shoreline?
Right. So even if there wasn't increased rainfall into the basin because of climate change, the water would still be eating at the toe of our cliff because of that isotonic rebound.
With the water lapping like that, what have your neighbors tried to do to hold up, you know, the cliff? You talked about how they've tried to shore it up and stabilize the bluff.
This is a very sad story, right? Our neighbors did not have a cliff that was quite as steep as ours, but it was steep. And they hired heavy equipment to come in and minimize that angle to the water. And then they planted it with grasses. They also hauled in huge boulders to prevent the waves from the water hitting the cliff and eating away at its toe. And they laid down hardware cloth, really sturdy, indestructible type of fabric before they put these big rocks down. So it was quite an obvious
engineering feat. Yes,
right. Engineering feat, but also an obvious change to what they looked out on. Mm. And today, those big rocks are about 10 feet out in the water. It didn't slow it down, I don't think, and it certainly didn't work. And they've marred that portion of the beach of Lake Superior by their efforts. It's just it just is not possible, I think, to actually have much effect on this very big ecosystem level phenomenon.
Sue Leaf is our guide to Lake Superior. New book is called Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior South Shore. And you can join the conversation. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, we're going to turn to bobbing, ice fishing.
Okay,
here we go. You have some choice words about these bobbers. What do you think about bobbers and the people who venture out on the ice to fish?
What I thought when I first heard of bobbers and when I first saw them in action in 1983 was I thought these guys are nuts. Okay, so in case for people who don't know what a bobber is, we're not talking about those little white and red spheres that you attach to a fishing line to catch panfish that are so exciting to watch going to under. We're talking about fishermen who are out to catch really big lake trout, and the lake trout hang out in deep water. So you have to get away from the shore far enough to reach a place where the lake is 200 feet deep. So in order to do that, you walk far out into the ice or take your snowmobile out far into it. But the catch is along the shoreline, unless the lake is totally frozen over, which almost happens like never, the ice is not secure. And so it might stay in place while you're out there, or it might break off. And so bobbers run the risk of having the ice that they're on break off and start to float away.
Floating island.
Yes, cracks between the shore ice in close and the other ice can widen to the point where your snowmobile isn't going to jump over it. But even think about this, if you're making your snowmobile jump over it, I mean, that itself is frightening. So they go out there and they can spend a day out in the deep, on the deep end fishing. And where they can tell when the water when the ice is drifting, because the current that their lines are subjected to seems to be shifting. But of course, currents don't shift. They're set, at least for the day. And that indicates that you are, in fact, the ones that is drifting. Okay, so that's why I thought they were crazy, because I thought, why would you risk your life just for a big fish? And they don't even eat these fish. Most of the fish, big fish are considered old fish, and they're good breeders. And so a lot of big fish get the picture taken and then they get released back into the water.
So you call up Greg Alexander, the bobber and emergency medical technician.
Right, he's a perfect resource because he sees the danger, but he also is caught up in this idea of the excitement of bobbing.
And he has, and he carries two pairs of ice picks. What are they used for?
Ice picks are this device with a nail coming out of each, like a cylinder of wood that you can hang around your neck. And if you happen to get put into the ice, you take the nails and you can get a purchase onto the ice to get yourself back out of the water and onto the ice. We always have them around our necks when we go skating on our lake. It's a standard piece of equipment. And Greg carries two, one for himself and one to give away.
One to give away to a bobber who might not be carrying one.
Right, who might need his services.
Oh, wow. And they also tap the ice from time to time with these ice rods. What are they listening for?
They probably can hear of the thickness, but they're waiting for the point at which the rod goes through the ice, which indicates them the ice is too thin to hold them. And then they back up from there and drill their hole. You know, before we leave the bobbing portion, I do want to point out that I've changed my opinion of bobbers because you meditate on what it's like out on the ice of Lake Superior. Once again, there's a horizon and it's a wilderness out there, but it's a wilderness that's always changing because the winds are changing, because the weather changes, storms come in. And so for people who want to test themselves under wilderness conditions, this is one of the last true wildernesses part in the area. And so it's to know yourself in the way that you get to know when you have a wilderness experience, that you can get it when you're bobbing.
It's just amazing to think of that, a wilderness experience out on this expansive frozen lake is like being all alone in a real wilderness. It takes the word in new directions.
Well, yes, but think about it. In a real wilderness, like the Boundary Waters canoe area,
yes,
people have cell phones. People see a lot of people. When you're in the Boundary Waters canoe area, the portages are well packed. The tree roots are exposed. The campsites are worn. There's a lot of people that pass through that quote unquote wilderness. In the bobbing world of the wilderness is new every day.
Author Sue Leaf, our guide to appreciating the ever-changing wonders of Lake Superior South Shore, new book, Impermanence, and Their Space to Talk. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get an intimate look at the pulse of the seasons on Lake Superior South Shore and the climate threats that will change how future generations interact with the watershed. Author Sue Leaf's new book is called Impermanence. Her family cabin is near Port Wing, and you can call in with a question. Share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sue, let's turn to your friends, the birds. During your summers on the South Shore, what have you observed about the migratory habits of birds?
Well, we have had shorebirds coming through in early August that I know they're already flying south, which is a common understanding, but we could see it personally. I had a Baird sandpiper, a couple of them, right on our shore one August day, I was reading in on the beach, and the birds were came in and right next to me. You could tell they were exhausted. They were sleeping the entire time, very close to me, just maybe too weary to be afraid of a human being. We see other shorebirds, like at the harbor at Port Wing on the sandy beaches, that come in on their migration. We have I really like warblers, and we have warblers nesting in our woods. We have Nashvilles, and we have magnolias and red starts. And we can tell when they go. And I think the immatures of the year go after the adults do. So the woods seem to be emptying. The woods are very quiet right now. We've also found that our eagles did not migrate this year. That they were the most obvious birds we had in the woods the entire time were the eagles.
Well, what might be causing these changes?
Well, you know, birds migrate because they don't have enough food to eat, not because it gets too cold. And as long as the lake remains open and the eagles have access to the fish there and also to roadkill, there's no reason for them to undertake the stress of migration and leave their home property.
Let's listen to the sound of a piping plover, and you call these shorebirds winsome. And that's courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. How have piping plovers fared along the South Shore?
Their numbers were greatly reduced, mostly because the beaches that they don't build much of a nest. It's very hard to actually identify a piping plover nest. They essentially lay their eggs right on the sand. So if the beach where they decide to lay their eggs is heavily trafficked by human feet, or by an increase in predators, they're not going to have success in reproducing. And they are prey to both people who walk the beach, people's dogs who walk the beach with them, and predators like skunks and raccoons, whose numbers have increased as the human population present has increased near the lakes. They were down to a very few breeding pairs, and those only off the coast or the shoreline of Lake Michigan, kind of by Sleeping Bear Dunes, but they had been seen in the past on Superior South Shore, and they are now breeding again on like Long Island,
mm-hmm.
And also some of the other Apostle Islands. I think Outer Island maybe had a pair.
A really earnest build back program for these birds on the Apostle Islands.
Yes, because they're an endangered species. And once they're listed on the endangered species, under the Endangered Species Act, you have to have a plan for bringing them back to a stable population.
And so the scientists will camp out and will follow these birds by day and document the pairs and what is happening to each. Can you explain a little bit about that attention to these particular piping plovers?
Well, yes, they camp out, they have a camp, and they spend 1 week intervals out there they bring their drinking water out, and they have to monitor the nests. These are usually like biology majors or recent graduates from college. And one of them told me that he had read a lot of books that summer by himself. They monitor the fate of each nest. They map out the territory of each bird. So they're getting a lot of just basic natural history. You know, that's true for most of the birds. We just don't know a whole lot about them. And you have to, in order to get them to recover, you have to know as much as you can. And they're having success in their nesting, and the young are coming back the next year to nest themselves.
There's an unsettling word or phrase in your book, unusable winter, and you say global warming is pushing the region closer to experiencing unusable winter. What do you mean? Yeah, what do you mean by that?
By unusable winter, I mean ice storms, freezing rain, slush, snow that you can't groom for a cross-country ski trail, a slushy lake that you can't skate on. You know, living in Missouri, where you have to endure frozen water in frozen form, but you can't play on it.
You have thought about the time that might come when cross-country skiing is no longer an option or an option for the span of winter. What is coming up for you?
Well, I have a child that lives in Madison, and it's hard for him to train for like cross-country ski races, at least on snow, because the snow doesn't hang around. But I think I remember a time when Madison had plenty of snow, and it's just the winters are getting too warm to have the lasting snow cover.
Let's land on your cabin transition. You took down your old cabin, built a new one farther from the eroding cliff. How has that been for you, that change?
Well, actually, the old cabin is still standing.
Oh, it's still standing.
Yes, okay. Because it has white pine paneling inside that we need to get someone in there to take it off so it doesn't go into the landfill.
Okay.
And when we do that, I'll be ready to see it go. I thought it would be wrenching, but, you know, our new cabin is so wonderful. And the old cabin seemed almost immediately to have lost its soul as soon as we were out of it. And the mice took over. The new cabin is small. It is at least as small as the old cabin was, maybe smaller. It has a lot more windows in it, and it's heated with in-floor heating, so that and it's tight, so we have no mice in it. So that's a huge improvement.
And it's very special that your architect daughter designed it.
Yeah, it was. She was great with her clients. And I have, she gave me a little writing room where I, you know, this is going to sound terrible, but I didn't care as much about looking at the lake as I did about getting constant sunshine. Because my writing desk was in a place that was going to be in the dark, you know, during the day, I don't think I would have sat there. I would have just taken my pencil and pad of paper and gone somewhere else. So yeah, we just came back from the cabin yesterday, and it's really fun to see the woods and snow. And we had tracks of what I think was a bobcat going down our driveway, and the bobcat seemed to follow my husband's snowshoe trail all over the place. So we were actually making the bobcat's life a little bit easier.
Oh, well, Sue, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Sue Leaf is author of Impermanence, Life and Loss on Superior's South Shore. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.